The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jennifer. I'm a librarian here at the Central Library. Before we get started, just a couple things to remind you of. If you could please turn your cell phones off. Just double check that they're off. And also, if you have to cough, if you have to sneeze, if you have candies to open, try to do that now, maybe. Okay? And also, be sure to join us after the program upstairs in the lobby for a book signing. Okay, tonight it is my large pleasure to introduce Nathan Englander. Nathan is the author of a short story collection published in 1999, fabulously entitled For the Relief of Unbearable Urges. This resplendent collection earned its 29-year-old author a prestigious Penn Malamud Award and the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. It went through 13 printings in hardcover alone, earned Englander comparisons to Philip Roth, Bellow, Flannery O'Connor, and James Joyce, and was translated into a dozen languages. Englander's short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, among others, and he was chosen as one of 20 writers of the 21st century by that magazine. Now, 8 years after the publication of his debut collection, having moved from Jerusalem back to New York, and having traveled to Argentina for a friend's wedding, and the friend's honeymoon, Nathan Englander is the still young author of his first novel, The Ministry of Special Cases. The novel is set in Buenos Aires in 1976, at the beginning of Argentina's dirty war that killed or disappeared between 9,000 and 30,000 people. It is about the fate of the disappeared and the fate of the Jews, about fathers and sons, about the laws of mourning and of marriage. It has been called a staggeringly mature work, poignant, powerful, political, and personal. Author and reviewer Allegra Goodman comments that I.B. Singer and Orwell both come to mind, but Englander's book is unique in its layering of Jewish tradition and totalitarian obliteration. Another reviewer says, the family in the story love one another and fight one another with gusto. Their monetary means may be meager, but their lives are not. He handles his unbearable subjects with a comic panache of a vaudeville artist, before delivering the final devastating blow. Englander makes the screaming sing. I had the substantial pleasure of reading The Ministry of Special Cases and found Englander's pugilistic prose to be refined, agile, and precise, emotionally and intellectually interrogatory, and heavy with wit, grace, and triangulations of trauma. He writes excruciatingly well of the places before, during, and after the heartbreaks. Please join me in welcoming Nathan Englander to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hi, thank you for that generous introduction. Very generous and accurate, but that you're a librarian. No, I was like, she's a librarian. Nobody ever, stuff is sort of right, close enough generally. That was hyper right. What else? This is my Metro card, which has nothing to do with anything, but this is how I get on the subway in New York. Hey, Harold. I lost this at WHYY, like, 5 hours ago, and it has been passed around Philly through like five people to get to Sarah and return to me here, which just makes this a nice city. That has nothing to do with anything, but I got my Metro card back. I don't ride the subway anymore. Those days are over. No. Anyway, so yes, stutter. Thanks for coming out. This is the start of my tour. I've been in cryogenically frozen for the last 8 years. Then you're like, why have you aged? True. Excellent point. Han Solo did not age. This is the part. Last tour, they didn't have the internet last tour. The kids have websites these days, they had to get a website. But also now, there's badinage at the beginning. Used to just come out and read somberly. So I just did a reading with Jonathan Lethem last week at the Y, which I talked about on the radio today. But it was just, again, he was at City 35, and he was just, again, a politician on point. So I have to learn to do my introduction. and I'm practicing on this generous room. This book is set in 1976 in Buenos Aires during Argentina's Dirty War, which they're talking about renaming, but to something really unsayable, like the oppressive regime's torture of it. Anyway, I think Dirty War, they don't like the idea that it sounds like a war between people, when again, it was a war against the citizens of a country. But it's such a gigantic thing, and I really felt the best way to tell such a gigantic story was not through just a million fragmented experiences, but through a single family, through a father, Kadosh Poznan, a mother, Lillian, and their son, Pato. For me, I just folded this whole world back into this single family. And it touches also, as always with me, there are Jews in the book. But there was a history of white slaving at the turn of the century, which the Jews worked in proportion to their how large a segment of the immigrant population they were. But nonetheless, there were Jewish pimps and whores in Buenos Aires, and the middle class was very ashamed of them, and they tried to hide this. They really still today, many people don't know about it or deny it or just don't want to hear about this part of history. And for me, I got really interested in the ideas of truth and memory and how we remember as nations. So I sort of wove that with the greater Dirty War. Anyway, I'm going to read to you from chapter 6, which is takes place at the start of the coup. As four men from the Navy threw a career Army man from the window, he was thinking his last thoughts. A retired colonel, his uniform covered in the ribbons and medals of a military regime, all those decorations were upended along with him as the blood rushed to his head. A medal came loose and clanked against the street. A chest full of honors, and what good did it do him? I should have served in the Air Force, he thought. Then I would have wings. With that, not even the time for a cynical upturn of the lips. He hit the Avenue of the Liberator, and along with the countless motions that make up a late night in Buenos Aires, that together are the heartbeat of any city in the world. Lillian Poznan turned her head on the pillow to have her last deep sleep before her fears turned real. Lillian didn't feel the city was Light One resident when she woke up. She didn't feel, as she often did in the kitchen with her bills, that the country was united and spinning out of control. Looking into the street, she didn't sense that there were right then a million more working stiffs in front of a million more windows, all in it together, all but the colonel, his window still open, a cat curled up on its ledge. Lillian had slept well. She'd woken up rested to find that Kadosh still hadn't come home, and, miracle of miracles, Pato had already left for school. She took her time getting ready. El Golpe, The Sting, played on the radio, and she tried to remember what theater she saw the movie in. She stood in her stockings eating a pastry over the sink as she decided on the beta on Laval. Lillian waited for the old cage elevator that ran up the center of their building like a spine, the staircase snaking around it. She waited with a hand on the gate, one knee locked and one knee bent to compensate for the weight of her briefcase. The door to Cacho's apartment opened. Her neighbor was still in his pajamas and had a worried look on his face. He scratched furiously at one of his eyebrows, and because of this, Lillian noticed that the other one was chapped and red. He was an early riser, a militant in his lifestyle. She'd never before seen Cacho in his bedclothes, never with a wrinkle in his shirt, even at the end of the day. She'd always felt he must keep an iron at the office, hidden in his desk. Are you home from work today, Cacho? Work today, he said, and went back to scratching. Work today, he repeated, standing up on his tiptoes to look behind Lillian and keeping an eye on the stairs. That's when the question turned entertaining, the best thing he'd heard in a while. Cacho gave a quick laugh. Work today, would you? Obviously, Lillian said, and held up her briefcase heavy with files. It's rhetorical, Cacho said, almost screaming. The question is, would you go to work if you were me? Would you go out this morning if you were me? Lillian had never seen Cacho like this, and, waiting for an answer to his rhetorical question, he switched to the other eyebrow, and she saw that on the first there was blood. He had scratched himself bloody. If you were in my position, would you even leave the house today? I don't know, Lillian said. What is your position? What does it matter? You're already in it and still you go. With this, he dropped his hand from his eyebrow, only to throw both arms up in frustration. He retreated into the apartment and slammed the door. Lillian was so intrigued by this, she didn't notice for another couple of minutes that the elevator was out again. She had slept well. She was happy and took the stairs. It wasn't long before Lillian understood the position she and Kacha were in, the one Kaddish and Pato were in, the position they were all in, especially, but not really any more especially, that their leader, Isabelita, was in or already out of that morning. Lillian was walking down Avenida de Macho toward the pink house and the plaza in front of it, the route she took every day. Except there was a roadblock up ahead, and beyond that a tank in the middle of the city. It was preposterous, and Lillian looked to her right and her left to see if there was anyone to share this with. She saw a man going the other way who would not make eye contact, and then in an empty parking lot a little way down, she spotted a Dodge pickup. In it were 8 soldiers in uniform, in helmets even, crouched down, covering the directions of the compass. 3 were facing her from the back end, where Dodge was stamped in large letters, and a pickaxe mounted across the name. The muzzles of the boys' machine guns stuck out over the truck's rear. Lillian looked behind her for the war, for the onslaught, and then again at these young boys, the kind that came knocking on the door for Pato, and then slunk off with him, record albums in a stack under their arms. These boys were neater, short-haired, and they were crouched down, guns at the ready. A flatbed truck with a tank on its back crawled across the next avenue. Another one followed behind. These trucks, moving through the city at a speed fit only for funeral processions, lumbering along. What is the surprise at this speed? Trouble does not break out anywhere in the world, Lillian thought. War is not unleashed. It is slowly, it is carefully installed. Lillian looked toward her neat little soldiers in their parking space. It's almost as if there should have been something to say. If they were not pointing guns, that is, if they were not in the military, she'd have said, there are tanks up ahead. But they probably knew that, could see them just as well as she did. Lillian turned around and went back to the last corner and took a different way to work. It seemed they were having a coup. It seemed they were having a coup, and for this, Cacho stayed home to scratch out his eyes. Frida was at her desk when Lillian walked in. She said before anything, Isabelita is trapped in the pink house. It'll be over before it starts. A day at the most, Gustavo was saying. We're going back to a military government. You'd think they'd have come home, Lillian said. Kaddish was gone and Pato off to university before I got up. Classes must be canceled. Where would the kids go? Lillian shook her head. When do I ever sleep late? Adaptability, Gustavo said. He was out of his office and inserting himself into the conversation as if Lillian had been talking to him. It was Gustavo's way of being boss, of owning everything there. He stood between them and smoothed down his hair. We have inbred ourselves into supreme adaptability, and now it's become a detriment. We'll get used to this government same as the last, and if it turns on us, we won't even see it coming. We'll go down thinking all is well. Gustavo said this as if the 3 of them were observing it from Switzerland. He spoke with a certain glee. Lillian nodded a thank you and turned her back to him and said very clearly to Frida alone, a truck full of men point their guns at me, and still I go on my way. Gustavo circled around and returned himself to the conversation. After the soldiers, who else should come to work more than you? We sell insurance. Today is what we're about. It's our big gamble. We pay out, others pay in. And, Frida said, dragging out the word, life, property, all the values shift. You'll see when things settle, much will become precious and many will have no worth at all. Frida gave up. She asked for the advice he'd dispense regardless. So then what do? Sit here and wait? We get down to business, Gustavo said. Life and death you can't control now. It is only profit that can be arranged absolutely during a war. Who are we having a war with? Frida said. That's the point. Figure out the sides and begin to earn. With that, Gustavo went back into his office. Lillian took Frida's hands. You'd think Pato, he's very sensitive. You'd think he'd have turned back from school. A glass floated above the floor, held steady by five fingers pressed from above around the rim. The fingers were of a hand, the hand of an arm, and the arm hung disembodied behind the back of the couch. Lillian dropped her keys on the little antique shelf. She dropped her purse loudly by the wall underneath. The glass held steady, the arm did not move. The television visible beyond the couch showed the Liberator's Cup, River Plate versus Portuguesa. The little men ran back and forth. Lillian couldn't see the ball through the smoke, a thin gray cloud in front of the black and white of the set. Lillian approached, leaning over and kissing Kaddish on the head. He put his cigarette in the ashtray resting on his stomach and placed the glass on his chest. "I'll know you're dead," she said, "if I ever come home and find that cloud missing or that glass knocked over on the floor." "What's wrong with ritual?" Kaddish said. "It doesn't hurt for some things to stay the same." "No," Lillian said. She agreed. Kaddish sat up with his back against the arm of the couch, his legs stretched out. He moved the ashtray to the floor. "Crazy day," he said. "Very crazy." Lillian smiled and went to sit. Kaddish raised his legs and Lillian slipped in underneath and patted them down. She closed her eyes and let herself relax. She listened for the music that was always on and always too loud emanating from Pato's room. Lillian couldn't hear it, and that only meant headphones or a grinding needle when the boy passed out. Creatures of habit, her husband and her son. They shared a great love for the comfort of sameness. "He asleep," Lillian said. "Out," Kaddish said. With a tilt of her head, screwing up her face, she stared hard at her husband, trying to understand. She stared hard at her husband and was already mad at herself. On coup day, on this day, how had she not raced straight for his room to check? Then there was Kaddish, this man who understood nothing, whom she could not for a few hours trust. "Out," Lillian said, "with the hairy one, that kid that looks like an octopus, all head." "Rafa," Lillian said. Then, as an afterthought, distracted with worry, "It is time you learned your son's friends' names." "He came by," Rafa did, "and they went off to some bar." Lillian pushed Kaddish's legs off her lap so that he sat up straight so that she could stand up and face him. "What bar do you think is open tonight? How could you let him leave?" She looked toward the door as if Pato might come through it. And then she asked Kaddish, quite calmly, "Don't you have any sense of your own?" "I told him he doesn't listen." "Then tie him up, hold him down. If your son doesn't listen, why didn't I find you by the door sitting on his back?" "Uncontrollable," Kaddish said. "By his father, uncontrollable. Rebellious Jewish boys only listen to their mothers. For fathers, they have no use." Thanks. I think it's question and answer time. I think there are microphones roaming too if anyone's brave enough to ask a first question. I don't have any relatives in the city to plant. There's Nomi, just as good. That's a fine question. Thank you. How much time did I spend in Argentina? It's very strange. I was there in 1991. That was said at the start. Thorough and accurate. But for a friend's wedding and honeymoon, and as I keep saying, they're happily remarried now. Don't take your friends on your honeymoon. But it was a good one for me. I'm very late for a writer. I should be at least on my second or third marriage now, and I'm not even started. But I didn't go back. I was there before I even knew I was going to be a writer. I was taking pictures then and being a hippie and, you know, let alone dreaming of novels. But, once I got started on this book, for me, it's more a Jerusalem metaphor or just we can talk about the ideas that sort of weave into the idea for a novel. But as I got going, it was just perfect for me to have this vague memory of Argentina for you know, building a world that was perfect to just remember sort of wide avenues or a dinner or the way somebody walked and just these fragments of memory. And then I built it, and as I actually, you know, I'm pretending like it's my own idea, but my editor and agent, basically speaking of sitting on people, they were sitting on me because they knew it would be another 10 years if I even saw Buenos Aires. But it also, it became an aesthetic thing for me. I actually decided that this is my world and I have to own this world. And so I built the whole thing and then only went recently. But might as well segue into research after that, but it's after the fact that I have a weird process where I do research after a book is completed, which is torturous to me and to everybody around me. I am the editor slayer, but it's really horrifying. But I believe in a fiction that anything you need to generate for the idea, anything that this book needs is true by virtue of its necessity, by the novel demanding it, and then anything that is not essential to story must be exacting. I will not, to me it's so important that an Argentine who grew up there and lived there in this time that there should be nothing, not a comma, not an idea, not a thought that would bump them from their world. So that's how I work. But yeah, really, it's an army of people. You know, thanks to Argentine friends in Jerusalem, there's someone I can call 24 hours a day to ask questions about ice cream flavors and things like that. Yes, ma'am. Oh, that little thing. Can I elaborate on, the Jewish white slavery in Argentina? So, at the turn of the century, again, I guess everybody, you know, people were, you know, doing the rag trade in New York or tailors or bringing all over these things from Russia. And the Jews in Argentina, there was, a sizable portion. There were people who were working as pimps and prostitutes in Jewish houses of ill repute. But, I just got, to me, it's this idea, I guess I got very, I'm so interested in community. I'm 37. If I wrote another book about religious and secular, like, that would be a problem of, you know, another book about high school was really not room for me. But I got really interested in the ideas of community and loyalty, basically. Loyalty to each other. I always think of it as like, if you create a community of the healthy and everybody's welcome, and then as soon as they get sick, we kick them out and it's always 100, that's not loyalty. You know, and I got to this idea of what a community's obligations or a nation's obligations are to its members and its citizens. And to me, it was just, I was more interested in these people's deaths than their lives because they wanted to be buried as Jews. And I've been using the Newt Gingrich example lately since about his affair when he was accusing Clinton. But this idea of that level, to me, that is just, you know, just, I can't believe people's levels of hypocrisy or lack of personal shame. But this idea in a sort of a global way that you could point your finger at somebody else and say, I decide that you are not a Jew. And these people wanted to be buried as Jews, which is very moving to me, you know. And these women, their choice, some of them were tricked into it. Some, you know, they could have died at the spindles in Europe. You know, it was surely a tough business. And just this idea that they wanted to be buried as Jews and they forced them, they had to form their own cemeteries. So the Tzvi Migdal was the name of one of the organization. They have their own cemetery, and it's overall. And I went to see it a couple of months ago, and it was, for me, like, it's not even a, as long as we're having this private, intimate moment, this is probably one of my most personal thoughts in the world, but it wasn't deja vu. I dreamed this place for a decade, and to see it, it wasn't deja vu, and it wasn't like a movie set. It was literally, for me, like accessing a memory to see, you know, these scenes from the novel. But the point is, there are these pristine cemeteries that are trimmed and lovely, and over the wall are these overgrown graves, knocked over headstones, weeds growing, and that idea of exacting a punishment for eternity is just so shocking to me. And they still don't want to talk about it. I mean, I was on the phone, this wonderful driver, Chorito, who saved me. No, I was standing in a gigantic Christian cemetery. I mean, the horror cemetery was, you know, as close as the fourth row. It was like a narrow street. They had never heard of it. Policemen that just nobody had heard of anything standing at the gate of this giant. They didn't know. And then I saw, you know, this guy tracked it down, sort of the driver. You saw his quizzical look. He was wondering why I made him drive an hour from Center City to, you know, everyone at the hotel desk was like, the guy wants to go visit another Jewish cemetery. They thought I was, but that's what I did. I had a friend with me, his father's a rabbi. He's like, this is how my dad travels. Nonetheless, I dragged him along. But just even finally, we're on the phone, like they let you in, there are forms to fill out. There was no way in the same day even to get access. And I literally, like my main character, ended up pulling myself over the wall to take a picture. And then someone obviously called the police and we had a little problem, but that was it. The police were very confused until I started, you know, escritor, you know, American writer and about cemeteries. And then I just started listing. Once I listed like my eighth Argentine cemetery, they're like, freak boy, isn't just really likes the cemeteries. Anyway, But yeah, I'm really obsessed with that community. So, yes, ma'am.
How has living in Jerusalem, how has it influenced your writing?
How has living in Jerusalem influenced my writing?
I'm assuming it has.
Yeah. It has. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was going to make an inappropriate bombing joke, but I'll skip that. How is Jerusalem? I'll tell you how it's language-wise. You know what, really core-wise? I mean, the global part of this story is I moved to Jerusalem. I see friends from Jerusalem here. But we moved there. We were going to make peace, which was really right there, by the way. Let's get political. It's so simple. Like five people in the world it takes to make war. You know, everyone wants, I think I said on the radio a bit, people want to send their kids to school and they want them to come home from school. You know, this idea that everyone wants to just kill each other all day is, you know, that's not how it feels on the street there. We're really almost there and could be there tomorrow, you know. But I would say we put a man on the moon and brought him back. That's already, you know, you can do whatever you need. But nonetheless, but yes, sort of the life of the individual, idea-wise, Jerusalem got into my head. Is the idea you're trying to live the life of the individual in Jerusalem, which is all New York is about. It's, you know, the individual, and that doesn't happen in Jerusalem. You're part of the country, you're part of the city, it's constantly invaded. You know, every day is like Tzom Gedalia or Tu B'Shvat. You can't get to the lot, everything's closed. You know, you can't even have a normal writing life there. So, idea wise, though, but just my apartment looked on the Knesset and the Supreme Court, the Parliament and the Supreme Court, and just this idea that, you know, constantly seeing helicopters overhead and stuff, that got into my ideas of the rights of a person to have a life that is not the nation's life, which really fed into this. But in terms of actually Jerusalem affecting me, I see why so many of my heroes lived abroad, why so many of the writers that I love were expats. It's not just, you know, the adventure of it, but living in Hebrew all day and writing in English all night was really, language starts to come apart for you. It just really starts to fall apart into its basic, you never think about, you know, words. Like a staircase is, you know, a set of stairs. Everything just breaks down that way. And in a sense of writing about a son of a whore, I just thought, except in America, we're prudish and say son of a bitch, which is not possible. But every other language says like, hijo de puta, benzonan. I thought we have these curses because I can think of better ones right now. Everyone think of your own thing that you'd scream when you stub your toe or someone cuts you off. But nonetheless, we have those, it's a thing language forms because somebody is a son of a whore. And I thought it's an insult to the mother, that's where it comes from. But I also thought it's an innocent thing, and that also, the idea of what we are bequeathed got interested. You know, it is a completely innocent position to be in. So I thought about this one man who might embrace his role as son of a whore. Oh, okay. I was like, the last sentence of the book you'll get yelled at. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'll repeat your question. Just, you want me to... Oh, that's just on the edge of being a question. That's a tough one. Expound on the last sentence I read. That's a query. Yeah, I guess, for mothers they have no use, I guess, but for fathers they have no use. I got it. But you know what, this is a book about fathers and sons in many ways and about that very difficult, if we're talking about identity and what somebody receives, you know, from their culture or from their world, I think it's a very hard position for, you know, to draw a 19-year-old boy, a 19-year-old Jewish boy. I just think it's that. Again, I made these, you know, I boiled this whole down, I pressurized this world and put it on three people. They're very different people, or I hope they read as very different people in this book. But for me, that, you know, that's another moment of recognizing, you know, that a son belongs to a father, but the son needs to find out that he is, you know, he is both his father and not his father. And I think that's just an age old, I mean, these are the giant conflicts, but I wanted to, you know, look at the, I guess, most pressurized, ugly form of it, but in a beautiful way. Because I think it's all... Look at me stutter through this. Is there a couch? I'll lay down and do it. But it's just a huge, you know what, it's. I think even in that horrible, where sons and fathers clash, I think that's based on love too, and I guess I wanted to look at that relationship. I just gave a signing lesson, and a father came over and said, this is my relationship with my son, happily, and he bought one for his son and for his own father, and I don't know, that touched me. It's the nice thing about coming on the road is finding out when things are hitting right, but it was exciting for me to meet somebody who understood that this is a very messy relationship, but that there is the bond there. That's almost an answer. Yes, sir.
At the same time,
Gotcha. Yes. Yes. Oh, that's a big one. What about Argentina spawns the junta mentality? Well, I guess that's, I feel like anywhere can spawn. It's more like choosing, this wasn't, and God bless him, but this wasn't a Michener project for me. I didn't say Argentina and then get my team like, go, Hawaii, the tell. But for me, it was really just, I guess I was really interested in how government works and how it falls apart. I feel like this mentality is everywhere, and I just feel, I guess I love romantic, tragic cities, and that's what Jerusalem is to me, a city with a great population, you know, that loves this place. Because I wonder what it is, if anyone who lived in Jerusalem, you're like, oh yeah, I hate the people, I hate the streets, I hate the government, you hate everything. You're like, I love this place. Like, what exactly? It's, you know, my walls are moldy, you know, everything's a complaint, but you're, and I said, what is it to love place? And I feel like that's Argentina, where, I mean, it should be a superpower stronger than America, and it is through graft and betrayal by the government that, again, they break these people. But they're all so loyal, and even my friends who recognize there's no future there have been gone for 20 years. They are diehard porteños. They live for that city. So, yeah, I was interested in love of place. But what is it about that government? That's what I was really exploring, is there's a big plastic surgery element in this novel, and that's an idea of, I just wanted to say hegemony on stage, cultural hegemony. But just this idea of what we accept on our own and what a government does to people. There are things we are forced to do, and then there are things that we play along with. And that's why this, Pato's books are burned in the novel, and he gets angry because I talked to somebody in Israel who had burned his own books, and that really just changed me as a book lover, you know, what that is. But I thought, you know, a good totalitarian regime, they take the books out and burn them for you. And this idea that it's such a polite country where you'd be expected to burn your own books at home is both, you know, beautiful and horrifying. So, and that was part, you know, this thing like spread through politeness. If somebody's nephew was taken, they wouldn't talk to their sister or brother anymore. It was just this like war of quiet. And I don't know why these things happen there, but I just feel like they happen anywhere. And it's more the slide that I'm interested in, like how do these things happen? Because I say still, you know, there's a line here, still with Isabelita it started. They just arrested that woman in January, Perón's third wife. They just arrested her in Spain after all these years, and it's good that they did. But this idea, we mark things. The coup is March 24th, and that's when it started. You know, the part that I read you, that's March 23rd. It's, you know, it ended March 24th, but it starts long before that. You know, and I mentioned the plastic surgery, but I feel like even that's a form of voluntary, you know, agreement that we're all going to have this one acceptable face in America, and it doesn't even look like a regular face. You know, I feel like we volunteer as a people to do all these things on so many levels. But I mean, you know, and again, I ended up with an accidental political position here, because when you talk about things slipping, I mean, again, this is, it's weird because I feel political now, but I don't have a political stance. I believe in the American Constitution, which makes me a radical leftist. You know, it's straight. But I started with a habeas corpus metaphor. You know, I was writing, it was a metaphor of what it means to be in a damaged country. And then they suspended habeas corpus here when I was like 5 years into drafting this. So for me, I again, it's not like saying, oh, it's going to happen here. But it is interesting to me that we, you know, just, I go, I'm interested in book tour now. I'm all about book tour, but I'm not interested, you know, that we have illegal wiretaps or, you know, the justice system is being routed. I mean, it's insane. And I feel like we don't notice. Actually, like there's, you know, terrible constitutional betrayals. So, is that a protest snore or just an actual snore? So, anyway. Yes. And the only two respectable professions were in the military and the priesthood. So you have the same phenomena that you have in many of the Latin American countries. And this is the unholy marriage between the military and the church. Now what you have is periodically, you have this type of revolution. When you change governments that perhaps move a little bit to the left, they will not last too long. Yeah.
They will not last long because right away that class of the aristocratic, the oligarchy, if you want, the aristocratic class,
Right, Irigoyen regime. That was the last good president. Yeah.
You have now all these governments are emerging again, and Chavez is now the Peron of my time.
Yes. I wish you could all hear this answer, which is hyper eloquent and exactly the audience member that I'm scared of for this book. except for the snoring guy. That's a whole separate matter. But that's hyper eloquent, and for me, because I'm usually in the rabbi business, but that was a fascinating element as I dug into this book. I didn't expect to... there's a priest that plays a central role in this book, but that also was fascinating to me. It's a very Catholic country, and also... this will definitely get another snore, but just the role of religion plays in... Like, we have to recognize the things that affect us, and the Catholicism of that country at that time played a very big role in what happened. And even in the targets is where they killed... the worst job to have. And this is why Jews were an outsized number of the victims, but they're also, you know, politically active and psychologists and psychiatrists. But they just killed endless psychologists and psychiatrists there. They hunted them ruthlessly because they felt if you're a good Catholic, you're probably giving confession. The idea is if you're going to the psychologist, you're probably a commie in some way. But this idea, you know, there was a real marriage, and bringing this priest in, you know, they were counseling them. You know, there were chaplains involved in this army, one very specific one who is sort of, I built my guy off him. Anyway, stutter, stutter. Should we take one more? Two more? I know you. Yes, sir.
So much of Latin art, particularly Argentinian art, has an element of fantastic allegory.
Yes.
And I've always found it very difficult to adjust to it. But this dirty war looks like a piece of fantastic art. Do you feel that?
Egad, that's the Hitler's a genius moment. It was pure evil. I think it is the purest form of totalitarianism that was ever built, because I feel like Argentines so love their country. Everyone else always tries, back to Alexander, everyone always tries to take over the world in the end. And I think in Argentina they actually could have been successful because they're so focused on their country, they could have actually succeeded in just taking it to their borders. And just, yes, it was a very perfect form of evil that they were building. So, yes, ma'am?
I read that you aren't religious anymore, and I was wondering how that changed your writing, or how it affected your writing, or...
How did not being religious affect my writing? I got an extra day of week to work, which is very important. Not at all. You know, it's just, I'm very thankful for the structures. You know, that's how... that really, I turn it into a form of like creative obsessive compulsive disorder, and I just, you know, I'm very ritualized, and that it's just, again, I don't know how, if we are born that way or trained to be that way, but that's the way my brain works, and I really take that idea. You know, I was always going to open a yeshiva for writers in Jerusalem and get funded, because, you know, my friends could sit there all day. They'll be there when you come counting for who the students are. But yeah, in that way, I use religious structure. I very much work that way and work out that everything in my life is, yeah, on that sort of sacred time clock. So, one more? Yes.
So, you've been with this book for a long time. How does it feel to sit with a project for so long and now it's finished? And what was that process like?
Yeah, you always need to be, I feel like, to be it's nice to discover you like to write. I really enjoy this part of it. I love traveling. I love meeting people. But it's nice to know that I want to get back and work. I feel process-oriented. I feel like it's the project-oriented people that, if they're project-oriented, they go mad after. Like, that's when the marriages break up or all kinds of things happen. So for me, it's just I already want to get to the next one. But I don't know. It's like being a different person. I can't even... As soon as you're done with the book, I don't even know the person who wrote it. It's sort of this strange feeling of it. It's more like looking at my house, my ceiling leaks, or I haven't paid my bills, or everything's broken, and I can't understand why I didn't do it, you know, why I didn't do anything for a decade. And, you know, my mother often answers and says, because you were crazy. But it was really like that. There really wasn't inside. I just feel like I've been in a bubble for a decade. So, yes, it's utterly freeing, but I sort of miss it, and I'm excited to get back to work. I keep saying last question. Geneva Convention. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you see yourself proceeding further? Are you going
I love the short story for now. I'm in love with the novel. My head is just lit up now. That's how I knew when I was done with this book, is just when one day I was writing the novel and I turned the page and I was writing a different novel. And that's the moment that I had hoped that my brain must have known there was space or an end to this. But in terms of, you know, being on the book after the last one, it's all overwhelming in equal proportion to last time. So I was all excited to see the stacks of books in the bookstore, until I talked to my agent, and then I understood we have to get them back outside, which is, I didn't think about that part. I was just happy to see copies. On that note, yes, I'll talk to you online. How's that? I want to thank you all for coming tonight. Thanks for having me. I'll go sign books.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.